is Over the Garden Gate, a program brought to you by the University of California Cooperative Extension Master Gardener Program of Tuolumne County. The mission of the UCCE Master Gardeners is to provide research-based gardening information to the public. If you would like to contact our Master Gardener Program, please call our hotline, which is area code 209-533-5912. The hotline is not manned full-time, but we do pick up our messages and we will get back to you within the week.
Hello everybody, this is Debbie Powell, the Master Gardener Coordinator for both Calaveras and Tuolumne County, and I'm at the Calaveras office in downtown San Andreas. I'm so fortunate to be able to talk to Scott Onetto. Hello, Scott.
Hi, Debbie. Thanks for having me.
And Scott, what do we call you these days? What is your job description?
Yeah, so I am officially back from a year-long sabbatical and coming back as a farm advisor. So I'll be working with local ranchers and farmers, helping them with any problems or assistance they may need.
Great. Yeah. That is wonderful. And you just assisted us in the garden, the demonstration garden.
Yeah, we're going to be
with the ride, the Calaveras Master Gardeners.
Yeah, that might be another great show topic.
Yes, yes. They're going to plan on a new demonstration. We'll keep you to stay tuned.
Yeah, we were looking at doing basically a small little demonstration at the government center in the Master Gardener Demonstration Garden, looking at various control treatments for weed control. So be looking at both some over-the-counter herbicides that people may be very familiar with, as well as a number of organic herbicides that are fairly safe to use, and also some mechanical control treatments.
I know, it sounds very exciting.
I
can't wait. It's always, what's going to happen? What's going to happen at the garden?
Yeah,
well,
yes.
It's really fun. But when you were on sabbatical, sabbatical is not a vacation.
It was just, not. It
just
was,
to keep that clear.
Yeah, definitely. I think I worked harder this last year than I have in a long time.
Oh, my
Yeah, it was a lot of really long days just sitting without any interruptions and just a lot of writing. So it was a very rewarding experience, but also very productive.
Well, good. And one of the things that you produced is a field guide. It says weeds, forages, and natives of the Central Sierra Nevada.
Yeah.
And this just came out.
Yeah,
this
so
is
it's
hot,
a
off, the
hot
press.
Off the press, a brand new publication, something that's been on my to-do list for, God, I hate to say it's been over 10 years now. We've produced a number of different field guides for landowners, for farmers and ranchers to help identify some of the more problematic weeds that they have. And we've had various different publications and posters or little field guides over the years. And we've been out of them for a number of years. And so one of my to-dos has been to recreate a field guide and update it. And so I spent a good majority of my sabbatical revamping some of our older publications. And so this turned out to be a fairly lengthy field guide. Our older one was maybe 20 pages long. And I think this one might be 170 pages.
It's
a little over 170 pages and covers roughly 80 different plants. And I say plants because I originally was just looking at highlighting weeds. And then once I got into finishing all the weeds, then I really started talking more with some of the agricultural groups locally, and they were like, well, what about some of the desirable plants, like some of the forages that our livestock want?
Sure.
You know, how do we tell the bad ones and from the good ones? Mm-hmm. And so that got me rethinking that I really should include some of those desirable forages and maybe the lookalike native. So we have a lot of native plants that also made it into the book. So mm-hmm. so people can see what native plants they have on their property as well.
Okay. So I'm looking at the shape of this book. It's really a nice shape. It really is.
Yeah.
It does say right at the top, field guide. So when you actually produce this book. What is the intent? How is it going to be used?
Yeah, so my intent, I wanted something that somebody would be inclined to use. So not just a book that they would have on a shelf in their home, but something that they would actually take out into the field. And so I purposely made it the size that it is, so it will fit in a back pocket. And also a great place to store it is in your glove box or in a little center console in a vehicle.
Right.
Just, you know, have it with you, because often when you're out and you see something that you're not sure what it is, it's great to have, you know, access to a book to be able to thumb through and try to find what that plant might be.
Not only to satisfy my curiosity as far as what a plant is, but why is it important to identify these plants?
Yeah, so, you know, I think a big portion of this is, you know, I call it a weed field guide. And, you know, basically a weed is, you know, a plant growing out of place. And that's kind of a very loose definition, because, you know, anything, technically anything could be a weed to somebody, right?
Sure.
But there's certainly weeds in there that, you know, can be much more problematic, and that not only for an individual person, but for industries. And mostly I'm thinking agricultural industries, so our livestock producers, or even, you know, poisonous plants around your home or landscape that might actually cause harm to, you know, maybe a child that doesn't know any better, or maybe a pet that you may have that's curious and wants to chew on things, you know, those little puppy phases that you have if you have a puppy. So really just being able to know what's in and around your environment, whether you live in an apartment or a condo, or maybe you have a home in a subdivision, or maybe you have 5 acres, whatever the situation you may be in, it's important to know what's growing around you. And so you don't have to know every single plant, but when you typically see a plant that you've never seen before, those are the ones that typically should kind of raise that red flag of curiosity to say, that looks different. I haven't seen that before. Maybe I should find out what that is.
Okay. Well, that now, once you have this guide, the field guide, and it is in your car and your back pocket, and you're traveling around with it, what is the best way to use it? Because I know you mentioned it's got about 100 and
yeah, so I organized
pages.
It into a couple of basically different sections, because I think for usefulness, you know, you want to be able to kind of identify a plant as quickly as possible. And so I basically split it into 3 sections. One, the first section is a section on what I call thistles and thistle-like plants, right? So things that look like a thistle. So people, for the most part, know what thistles are. It's those spiny plants, you know, things that are often in the sunflower family. You know, things like, you know, yellow star thistle and milk thistle, all these things that we, you know, commonly associate with thistles.
Plants.
Yeah, typically
the ones you don't want to touch.
Yeah, these are typically the ones that are pretty pokey and ones that you just don't want. And so we've got a section, if a plant looks like a thistle, there's a section that just has thistles. So you can turn to that section. There's also a section on grasses. And again, that's a fairly broad and loose term. So anything that kind of looks like a grass, there's a section that you can turn to in the book and then just thumb through those pages to see if the plant is in there. There's also a section on trees and shrubs.
Okay.
So if it's a plant that's, you know, large, like a shrub or a full-size tree, or basically woody is kind of the definition that I would use to distinguish a tree or a shrub, you can turn to that section. And then there's a section on vines, which would be things like poison oak or English ivy, things that kind of have a viney growth structure. And then there's the last section is things that are the non-thistle broadleaf plants. So basically anything that has a broadleaf that isn't a thistle, those are kind of grouped in their own little category.
Okay. Gosh, that's great. Now, there's something else that I noticed. You rate the weeds.
Yeah, so I try to distinguish, you know, the good ones from the bad ones.
Are there good ones?
There are some of the desirables in there. So I, you know, made sure if I included some plants that are good to have around, whether it be for, you know, livestock feed or for maybe it's a great pollinator, any of those kinds of characteristics or attributes, I try to make note of that. But then for the weedy ones, I tried to also give some ranking as to, you know, some of the worst of the worst I tried to really call out. And so I put a little what I call take action button.
It's
very impressive. Yeah, it kind of reminds you of the Staples.
Right, exactly. It does.
Whatever that little button said.
I almost want to press it.
Yes. So those weeds that, you know, are some of the worst of the worst, typically they're in fairly smaller populations because many of the counties and state jurisdictions are trying to keep those weeds under control. So I tried to make sure I identify those. So if people see those particular weeds, those are ones that you just don't want to not pay attention to, that you really want to take action and do some sort of a control treatment.
Okay. Now you actually talk about how to control it.
New addition that I added to this field guide that all of our previous ones really didn't have. Our previous ones mostly just had a few pictures, mm-hmm. and a little bit description about the weed, and I really wanted to make sure that I covered some control strategies. So if somebody does see a weed and they want to take action, I wanted to give them some different techniques for control, and I tried to cover both chemical and non-chemical. So if there's some treatments that don't use chemicals that are effective, I tried to make that very clear, whether it was hand pulling or maybe it could be using weed eaters or a shovel, or maybe using livestock as a tool if you have animals. I tried to make those in there if it was an effective treatment.
So you've covered the whole range in a very small space.
I had to use a very small font.
There's a lot of information.
You may need to put some readers on because, the text is small. I tried to get as much as I possibly could in that book.
But with the pictures, you've got beautiful pictures, and you've got pictures of the plant when it's young.
Yeah, I tried to include some different stages of growth for each plant. So like you said, either the seedling or very small early growth stages, as well as later on as they start to flower. So different stages throughout the year, hopefully that'll help with identification.
Right. And then even you've got a picture on the Canada thistle as far as what it looks like in the landscape, which is really nice. Looking at the bull thistle, there's a variety of pictures in the seedling stage when it's starting to flower. The pictures are really nice.
Yeah,
I
was
have to admit,
very fortunate. I have a colleague that retired a few years ago who was a weed scientist at UC Davis, but also an amazing photographer. So a lot of the photos are from Dr. Joe DiTommaso, and then the others I got permission from a number of other folks that contribute to some online weed galleries. So I think there's I took a number of photos, but I relied on others that had some just really good photography skills.
I rely on photos a lot, so if I'm out in the field and my phone doesn't work, I want to look at
exactly.
a picture. So this is great. There's another really beautiful thing about this field guide. I understand it's free.
It is free, yeah. So that was one of the things I wanted to try to do was create a guide that was available to the public and made it free. And so through many gracious donations, and I will read them off because I think they warrant being acknowledged, a number of local organizations helped give funds to make this publication available. And so including ourselves, the University of California Cooperative Extension, we also got funds from the Amador County Department of Agriculture, the Amador County Farm Bureau, the Amador County Resource Conservation District, the Calaveras County Department of Agriculture, the Calaveras County Resource Conservation District, the Tuolumne County Cattlemen's Association, El Dorado County Department of Agriculture, the Motherlode Land Trust, Tuolumne County Department of Agriculture, Tuolumne County Farm Bureau, Tuolumne County Resource Conservation District, and then the two huge sponsors that really contributed a lot towards the funding of this book was the Northern California Power Agency and the East Bay Municipal Utility District.
Oh, that's so wonderful. So anybody can come into the Cooperative Extension office and pick up one of these books for free.
Yeah, so come by one of our offices across, whether you're in Jackson, Placerville, San Andreas, or Sonora, any of our Cooperative Extension offices will have them, as well as the county agricultural departments.
Okay.
I'm also, some of the local pest control businesses have also taken some stock of these as well and are handing them out.
Great.
And I would actually like to get them into some of the local feed stores as well.
Oh,
so
perfect.
We'll try to get those out here in the next few weeks.
Okay.
And so, yeah, they're free. Come in and get one for yourself, grab one for your neighbor. Really the purpose is to get this information out. So
perfect. But it's also online.
It is, yeah.
That's where I saw it first.
Yeah, this was the first time I've ever done, I guess you could call, an ebook. And so we did put it online. And so if you have a mobile device, whether it be an iPhone or an iPad or any other mobile device, you can go to our website, our Central Sierra website, and it's available right on the home screen. You really can't miss it.
Right.
It's currently not downloadable as a book. You have to have internet access to use it, but we are working on a downloadable version as well.
Oh,
so
wonderful.
So yeah, go to our website, cecentralsierra.ucanr.edu, or just Google search
Central Sierra Cooperative Extension. It's right there. And it's a great field guide. Thank you so much for coming in and talking about it. We ran out of time. We'll have to have you come back.
Great.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you so much.
Hello, everybody. This is Debbie Powell. I'm the Master Gardener Coordinator for both Calaveras and Tuolumne Counties. And I'm in Sonora today talking to Lisa Page, who's not only a Tuolumne Master Gardener, but she's president of the Tuolumne Master Gardener Program. Hello, Lisa.
Hi, Debbie.
How are you doing today?
I'm good today.
Good, and you have always a wonderful vegetable garden at home, and then of course you also are in charge of the vegetable garden at the demonstration garden, which together with all these years of gardening experience, over 27, you've got a lot of experience with growing vegetables.
Yeah, I do.
And I kind of think you've probably encountered a few bugs from time to time.
Yes, I have.
And that kind of is our subject today, as far as what do you do about bugs. But also talking with you previously, we found out that you stick to organic gardening practices, which can be difficult when you're dealing with bugs.
Yes.
Or challenging.
It's challenging, yes.
So you had kind of mentioned that maybe some of the cutworms can give a problem from time to time.
Yeah, cutworms will show up when you have a brand new vegetable plant. It happened to me, I had planted some pole bean seeds.
Okay.
And every time the little seedling had come up, it was cut off right at the soil, hence the name cutworm.
Okay.
So the plant would fall over because it ate right through the stem at the soil level. So I knew it was cutworms. The first remedy I tried was to take toilet paper rolls and cut them in half and place them as a little protective barrier around each seedling, which can be kind of challenging because I do a bean teepee and there's quite a large number of seeds around each leg.
Right.
But I did that. But the thing with that is if you're watering, they get wet.
Oh, sure.
And it doesn't last very long.
Yeah.
So next, I finally read that if you put cornmeal out around your seedlings, that the cutworms will eat the cornworm, and then it expands in their body.
Okay.
And they die.
Because they just, okay.
Because they're only so, they're probably, what is that? Maybe a half inch.
Maybe.
They look like little, really, really tiny, not little. Tiny, but they look like a grub.
Okay.
They're white with the little brown face.
Okay.
I never got that close to the face, but it's where their head is. So, but you rarely see them unless you're turning your soil over.
Okay.
which is probably
so they live in the soil.
Yeah, which is probably why I had them in that particular bed that year, was that I had not turned that soil as often as I normally do. So I think that that's probably what happened, why they came that year. But those, I found the cornmeal method was the best, unless you want to replace those toilet paper roll collars all the time.
And would they last maybe, do you think, a week?
Through a few waterings.
Through a few waterings.
When you've got seedlings, you're watering quite often.
Right. So they just,
they kind of fall apart, and then the hornworms get over.
Okay.
And actually, I found, too, when they were intact, it kind of slowed down the earwigs, which will also take care of your
seedlings.
But cornmeal didn't do anything for earwigs, though. But cornmeal was my best solution.
Okay, you know? That's a good one.
So especially if you've got some that's stale in your cabinet, I've put it away and marked it specifically for that purpose.
Sure.
And that actually, that that was my solution for that one.
That's a great one. How about, what other kind of problems have you had?
Well, in early on, I would have cabbage moss. When I used to plant a winter garden, they always go for any of the brassica family. Cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower, and they like to lay their eggs on the leaves. But you'll see the pretty white moss flying around. I think they have a little blue speck on their leaves.
Uh-huh.
So you think they're a butterfly.
Mm-hmm.
You see them hanging around your cabbage and stuff, and that's what they do. Well, years ago, I read that BT, which I can't pronounce the name,
full name. Mycelium thuringiensis, something that, like
yes,
that.
That's very
close enough.
So I read that that was an organic method. Well, come to find that, because it will kill the caterpillars, because when those eggs hatch, they turn into, I think they're little green caterpillars, if I recall, which you rarely see because they're not even a quarter inch, I don't think. They might, you don't rarely see them. But it's the caterpillars that do the damage. They eat the leaves of your cabbage and stuff. So the BT also kills good caterpillars too, so I immediately stopped using that.
Oh, okay.
So you're basically, the only thing you can do to keep the cabbage moss off your plants is to have a floating row cover.
Oh, okay. And what does that look like?
Well, for me, you can buy, it looks like a thin, almost muslin cloth. It's not muslin, but it'll be a thin, filmy cloth that's kind of white. You can get it with varying degrees of light that can come through it. I just have a really light one that I bought for frost, but it works. It lets light through. And I would just put it over the little, I had some little decorative fencing, wire fencing that you put around there to keep the cats out. I put it over that, use clothespins to clip it on there just to keep them.
Okay.
Because they're not going to go under it if there's a little bit, you know, half an inch off the ground, because they're flying creatures.
Right.
So that's basically the exclusion, you call that, is the only way to really keep the cabbage.
That's a great idea, though. And that works.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you're willing to do it, unless you want to try to chase the moths away all the time, I don't think that'll work.
Nope, I don't
think
so.
But I tell people after I learned that, I will not use BT because I do not want to kill the good caterpillars.
Sure.
And especially when we have problems with our low populations of monarchs and things like that.
Oh, so, definitely. Yeah. I mean, there's so many schools out there trying to put in monarch gardens and grow milkweed to provide.
We don't want to kill those caterpillars.
No, that's a great thing to do, not kill the monarchs or any of the other ones. How about, do you ever come across problems with slugs?
Only in the really wet springs that we've had.
Okay.
And there's a couple of ways that you can, exclusion, if you are, we have some strips of copper. If you can put copper around the edge of your bed, you know, I don't know, maybe a couple inches high, but down into the dirt.
Okay.
They won't climb over copper. I guess the copper gives them some kind of electrical shock or something.
Hmm.
But since copper is expensive and most people don't run, have, I just had it as around my property. I've also seen where people have actually put pennies all around the edges of their pots on their porch.
Oh, yeah.
They'll glue them to this edge, and same thing.
Right.
But, you know, that's a little bit labor intensive. I don't use slug bait. I think you could probably put up crushed eggshells because it's a soft-bodied creature mm-hmm. and him crawling across it, but you'd have to put it around each of your plants.
Oh, gosh.
The slugs are creative, believe it or not. I had plants up against a rock wall,
mm-hmm.
and in that rock wall there are some grasses that are, get very long and fountain down. Well, I saw a slug lowering himself down on a piece of that grass just to miss the copper that I had around the edge of the thing.
Oh, my gosh.
So, we're back to the tuna can method.
That's disappointing.
Tuna can method. This is the best way to catch slugs.
Okay.
You get your tuna can, cat food can, sink it down so that the top is with it, level with the ground, and you use beer.
Beer?
Beer. They like beer.
They like
beer. So you pour beer in there, you come out the next day, and you're going to have a thing full of slugs. So obviously you have to empty it and refresh it all the time. But that's your best slug trap.
Okay.
So the copper or the beer, those are the two methods that I've used.
Those are both great methods.
But the eggshells will also work. And I think diatomaceous earth may work because it is also coarse to soft-bodied animals.
Right.
I haven't tried that for slugs. But like I said, they can be creative. And they will hide under boards.
Oh, the slugs will. They'll hide under things.
Because it's cool and damp under there. So that's when you're going to find slugs and snails, the beer bait will work for the snails also. Mm-hmm. I really don't have snails in my yard. Once in a while I'll find one, but I think they came in on a plant from another county.
Oh my gosh.
And I brought some plants up from Santa Cruz when my mom moved, and I think they were in her outdoor plants because she had snails, and I had never had snails before that, but I've rarely find them in my garden.
Gosh, that's great news. How about, do you have problems with harlequin bugs, or?
My experience with harlequin bugs, I got a call from a friend of mine who calls me her personal master gardener.
That's nice.
She says, I got all these black and red bugs all over my turnip greens. And I'm going, ladybugs? She said, no. So I went over to her house and.
You were hopeful.
So I went over to my house and her turnip greens were completely covered and I instinctively knew what it was. I must have read it when I was learning in Master Gardeners. It's harlequin bug. It's in the Liguus bug family, which covers stink bugs. Any bug that has an armor-shaped body.
Okay.
Or shield-shaped.
Right.
Shield-shaped body. And it's really a pretty bug, but it's a sucking bug. So she had so many, normally I would say, they say plant a trap crop, which is something else that it likes to draw it away from the plants that you have.
Oh.
Like for turnip greens, they said plant some mustard a little ways away.
Because it would prefer eating mustard.
So it would all go over
the turnips.
Mustard. Okay. And I've actually seen Dombacher Farms plant trap crops for things.
And that's
like
what
that.
They call it, trap crops.
Trap crops. So it's either that or you plant something that you're willing to sacrifice. But she had so many that it came to a point where I said, you're just going to have to pull up all the plants and put them in a garbage bag, seal it up tight. And that's the only way to get rid of them. And in that same family, my personal experience has been with the stink bug that we'll see occasionally. They come in green and brown. And if your tomato plants are... The first time I really had a bad problem was if they're not getting enough air through the plants.
Okay.
Another master gardener had given me this tomato cage to use around a tomato at the demonstration garden, and it was made of ranch wire, and it made just a big circle.
Right.
Well, the plant got so huge that it was almost like really crowded in there, so you don't have a lot of air going through there and a lot of light going through there. So the stink bug finds a lot of places to hide and you can't get to them. So what they do is, it's really not a horrible amount of damage, but you'll get these little yellow spots on your tomatoes, which will actually turn hard. Mm-hmm. And that's where the stink bug has injected, it's put its mouth in there and injected whatever it injects in there. If you get too many, though, it can make your fruit kind of,
misshapen?
Not misshapen, but you can't eat those hard parts.
Okay.
Some people will freak out and not eat the tomato at all. I just cut that part off.
Yeah, because the rest of the
tomato
is
fine.
Okay.
But with stink bugs and harlequin bugs, you know, it goes back to the same as like squash bugs, who I don't think are in the same family, but it's just basically hand picking.
Okay.
And it's that, making sure you've got enough airspace.
Okay.
So,
a preventive measure.
Yeah, preventive measures. I'm not sure where they lay their eggs. That would probably be another thing. Like, they probably are one of those that lay their eggs down in the soil mm-hmm. to overwinter. So mm-hmm. once again, it's that turning your dirt over in the winter at the end of the...
Well, Lisa, again, we ran out of time. And I just want to thank you so much. And of course, we're going to have you back again. And thank you so much.